everybody, and Happy New Year! I thought that as a way to mark 2021, I'd take some time to tell you about 10 movies I was very enthusiastic about this year. This is obviously not an exhaustive list of the movies I liked, but this year I had a lot of time to do one of my favorite things, which is just hunker down and watch some films. And with a lot of them, I had a lot to talk about and nobody in the immediate vicinity to do that with. So I'm going to do that now. These are in no order and no particular year. Just movies that I really enjoyed or otherwise had something to hang on to or be fascinated by or just really stood out to me. Enthusiasm comes in many forms. So one thing that I really got into particularly this year is 90s movies. They just have a sense of coziness for me. And in this year, that sort of comforting feeling was something I really appreciated. So the first one I'm going to talk about, I first heard about on the Blank Check podcast, where they sort of go through filmographies of certain directors. And this is a movie that almost nobody has heard about, and it is the directorial debut of Nora Ephron. It's from 1992, and it's called This Is My Life. It stars Julie Kavner, who is the voice of Marge Simpson, as a single mom who becomes a comedian, and her relationship with her daughters, she sort of skyrockets to fame, and how that really develops between the two of them. I really loved this movie, and as they talk about on the Blank Check podcast, it basically doesn't exist. It's pretty hard to find, but it is available to be rented on YouTube, and that's what I ended up doing. I decided to indulge myself one July night. It's just, it definitely has that comforting factor. I think it's just really well written and acted. The story with the daughter is really good. The clothes the daughter wears are great. It's 1992, so there's something really special there you can trust. And I just think it's a movie that maybe more people should know about and look into. I mean, I can sort of understand why it sort of just fell in the cracks of history, because it's not hugely dramatic or like totally out there in any way, but has like lots of great cameos. It's like genuinely funny and smart. It is bizarre for me as somebody who hasn't really ever seen or Julie Kavner in anything other than The Simpsons, or even knew who she was really until I discovered this movie. Like for the first, actually maybe for most of the movie, you just hear her voice and you're like, that's Marge Simpson. Because that is basically just what her voice sounds like. Marge Simpson is her exaggerating it a little bit, but overall you're like, wow, this is a human being's voice. So This Is My Life, directed by Nora Ephron. The next one is another cozy 90s movie that I had been meaning to see for probably over 10 years, called Home for the Holidays from 1995 and directed by Jodie Foster. So the origin story of me wanting to watch this movie is probably, let's say 2010, maybe 2009, watching Robert Downey Jr. on Inside the Actors Studio. I have a particular relationship with Robert Downey Jr. in that I appreciate him very much, not all of his work, and he obviously has a very particular persona these days that some people are really into and some people are really not. And for me, I think it's a mix of both, but he is a very good actor. He is astonishingly good at doing his job. And yeah, that was basically what piqued my interest about this movie. One particular thing he says, no, it's actually, you know what? I completely lied. It is not Inside the Actor's Studio, where I heard him talk about this film. I think he does talk about it on that, but I'm so sorry. The honest to God truth is I heard him talk about this film on an Oprah appearance. Yeah, I went through a phase where I was watching everything, any interview I could see of Robert Downey Jr. I'm a human being. I was 14 and 15. It's fine. And in that Oprah interview, he talks about how he was so zonked out on the set of that movie that he was building a rocket ship in his trailer. And that's something that stuck in my mind for many years. I should also say, I'm very dazzled and just think young Robert Downey Jr. is so beautiful in particular. Like one of those things is he, in those early movies, his eyes are always so like glossy. And of course I realize that is because he's off his tits, most likely, in every moment he appears on screen. To get into this actual movie, it's directed by Jodie Foster. She's not in it though, which I always thought she was, but it's Holly Hunter who plays the lead. Whenever I Googled it and I saw the cover, for some reason, I think my brain just thought that was Jodie Foster, just going off of assumption. I always thought it was a Christmas movie, but it's a Thanksgiving movie. Holly Hunter plays a single mom. Her teenage daughter is played by Claire Danes, and she is working as an art restorer, and she gets fired the day that she is also going back home to spend Thanksgiving with her family. And she's dreading it, and she's feeling very vulnerable. She gets fired from her job and then kisses her boss randomly. And then Claire Danes drives her to the airport. And then right before, I mean, you can watch the movie, but there's lots of really nice moments. This movie, while it being a comforting, cozy 90s movie, I have to say, it's also one of the most unhinged movies I've ever seen, particularly Robert Downey Jr.'s performance. He plays the gay brother who is kind of detached from the family and avoids most family gatherings, but because his sister is feeling really vulnerable, he comes just for her. His character is sort of like, you know, just like that high energy, totally out there, really like imp. Strong imp energy, totally out there. Like, there's moments watching it where you're almost like, this is not a person. No, I should rephrase. There's moments watching it where you're like, this is so Robert Downey Jr. And yet I still feel like the character feels believable. Also, John Cameron Mitchell plays his husband in a couple scenes, which, who knew they played husbands? Yeah, I just love this movie and it didn't disappoint. There was moments where I was like, oh, okay, what is this? But by the end of it, I was like, what a great movie. What a great, often overlooked movie. And I will definitely be watching it again. The next one is something a little bit more recent. Unlovable from 2018, directed by Susie Unesi and written and starring Charlene de Guzman. I remember first reading about this movie in some ad for probably the Calgary International Film Fest, and it was on the cover of, I want to say Fast Forward, but maybe Fast Forward had already shut down. Beetroot? It was on the cover of one of those. It's partially autobiographical, written by Charlene de Guzman, about a woman who goes into treatment for sex and love addiction, which really interested me when I first read about it, because I don't think I've ever seen a movie that touches on that in that way. Something I'm always looking for is movies that really explore relationships and love and all that stuff in ways that I haven't seen before, in ways that I think we don't talk about a lot. And the character basically is spending a certain period of time sober, living in the house of her sponsor, and ends up meeting John Hawks, who is this sort of hermity guy who lives next door, and they start a band. And this movie made me feel so good. Even though it deals with rough topics, I feel like it truly just filled up my soul with like hope and joy, and is really about how pursuing a creative endeavor can help you heal and just bring a lot of joy. And yeah, I don't know. It's Unlovable. It's very lovable. I loved it so much. It's produced and I think also co-written by Mark Duplass of the Duplass brothers, who are known for doing a whole bunch of independent films, and also have been in like a lot of comedies. They both played brothers, these like weird gynecologists, like naturalist guy. No, naturalist is the wrong word, but like these sort of hippie gynecologists on the Mindy Project. That's them. But they've also made a lot of movies. Truly cannot recommend this movie enough. It feels very relevant to now, to sort of like the younger generation. It just really provided me with a lot of nutrition. Next is Ava DuVernay's 13th from 2016. The description of it on IMDb is an in-depth look at the prison system in the United States and how it reveals the nation's history of racial inequality. Now, this movie has been critically applauded and celebrated so much already. I mean, you probably don't need to hear it from me, but it provides such a clear trajectory of the history of anti-Black racism in the United States and the continuing mass incarceration and how it got to that point and what led to what and how policies evolved into different policies to continue oppression. It is just one of the best laid out documentaries I've ever seen in my life. Something that's really interesting that I remember reading about at the time it first came out is how Ava DuVernay sits like these really sort of legendary speakers like Angela Davis in these really opulent spaces for their interviews. I would say the spaces that each person who is interviewed feel very intentional. And that is something that is really interesting that I can't really say I've seen in other documentaries, but I mean, I'm not a documentary hound, so maybe that technique has been used before, but it's particularly interesting what information you can sort of get from the space that a speaker is placed into. And as you can imagine, there's all kinds of speakers kind of spanning the gamut of, spanning the moral gamut. You can watch the whole thing for free on YouTube if you don't have Netflix. It was put up for free about 8 months ago, according to the YouTube listing, but it's still there. Yeah, I can't recommend it enough. It's so interesting and well done, and I would encourage anyone, I don't know, maybe if you have family members or folks who could benefit from a little bit more knowledge in history on this topic, to watch it, but I would also recommend it to anybody who hasn't watched it. I mean, particularly white people. This is just so packed full of information, yet doesn't feel overwhelming or crowded. Even though the subject matter is obviously quite heavy, it's really engaging to watch. And it especially also contains a lot of interesting information about political figures who are still relevant and have been relevant very recently, and really draws clear lines from even like the 90s to where we are now, and has some really sobering statistics as well. So yeah, 13th by Ava DuVernay from 2016. The next one is a movie I watched half of, or maybe even less of, in high school in COM, which, if you're not Canadian, is kind of like the life skills health class that you have to take one term of in high school in order to graduate. And I just want to say, I really enjoyed COM. I tried to do it online in grade 10 and totally bombed because online courses aren't the best for me as far as keeping me accountable and self-disciplined, but it was so good. I don't know. I just, overall, I was pretty satisfied with that class. It was maybe even one of my favorite classes I took in high school, which is maybe weird. But this movie is Philadelphia from 1993, directed by Jonathan Demme, starring Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington. So I'd been meaning to watch the rest of this movie ever since high school, because I remember that third of it that I watched being very good, and I was listening to, again, the Blank Check podcast, where they were talking about this movie. And one thing they come back to again and again in that episode is how this movie has sort of developed a reputation over the years of being one of the classic sort of Oscar grabby bait movies where there's a big issue that has been parodied like a lot over the years. And in that podcast, their main takeaway is that that's sort of an unfair evaluation of Philadelphia, and the actual movie is much better and much weirder than people give it credit for. And after watching it, I can say I pretty much agree. Tom Hanks plays a man with AIDS who's a lawyer and gets fired essentially because his bosses find out he's gay and he has AIDS and goes to court to sue them and can't find a lawyer. And Denzel Washington eventually comes on as his lawyer and is homophobic. So all of this, like, as you tell it, it does sound like one of those very, very uncouth Oscars-y movies. But I think it's done so well, and it's not what you think it's going to be. And it has such beautiful moments. There's a moment towards the end of this movie, which if you've seen it, you know what scene it is, where the tone shifts slightly from the tone of the rest of the movie, and it goes into a little bit of a different zone, and it is one of the most beautiful scenes that I can think of seeing in a long time. I was absolutely floored. I'm a Tom Hanks fan. He just, like, is very calming for my brain whenever I watch him in something, as I think he is for most people. But I have to say, he absolutely deserved the Oscar for this movie. Now, in 2021, I think that we're kind of over casting straight men as gay men, or any straight cis person as LGBTQ plus people who then go on to win awards for it and are celebrated for doing a really good job of pretending like they have a certain life experience when other people with that actual life experience aren't recognized. And I completely understand criticisms of this movie for that fact. I think that is 100% fair. Something really interesting, I think, that they mentioned in that Blank Check episode is that part of the reason Jonathan Demme made this movie was because he felt really badly about Silence of the Lambs, and which I haven't seen Silence of the Lambs, but I know all about the, what is the name of the character, Buffalo Bill character, and the problems with that portrayal. And he wanted to make a movie that addressed AIDS, and I think he'd also had some friends who had died. And also that in Tom Hanks's acceptance speech for one of the awards he won, I haven't watched any of them yet, but apparently one of the speeches was the speech that inspired In-N-Out with Kevin Kline. So that's fun to know. But yes, he apparently in one of these speeches, or maybe more than one, he lists like a ton of names in his thanks. And these are actors who were cast in the movie who had AIDS, and like most of them died before the movie came out. And it's very interesting watching it and seeing, even in the scenes where ostensibly there are no gay characters, they're actors who you are kind of like, oh yeah. Like, it very much feels like queer people are involved and sort of fill up this movie. Even though the two gay leads, which are Tom Hanks and then his boyfriend, is played by Antonio Banderas in one of his earliest American roles, which is quite interesting. Very beautiful man. My God, it's stunning. But yeah, this movie absolutely floored me. There is a Cancer Moon, but I don't cry very much at movies, and this movie absolutely broke me and was honestly like a moment of experiencing the sublime for me. It really, yeah, it's another like many of these. I don't know that people talk about it that much these days, but it just, yeah. And it's filmed very interestingly because Jonathan Demme is kind of a weird filmmaker. I mean, this is something, again, they bring up in the Blank Check podcast. I don't want to repeat everything they said, but because I started that podcast and then about 20 minutes in, I was like, I should watch it. And then I ended up sitting down, watching the whole thing, crying, getting up and watching to the rest of the podcast episode. So everything they were discussing is very much like informing my thoughts and assessment of this film. I think it's such a beautifully done film. And I feel like recently within my generation, there's been sort of this upsurge in learning about and coming to terms with the AIDS crisis. And it really felt like it spoke to me in that way and felt very relevant to me right now, where I think my generation is old enough that we're realizing where the older generation of queer people are, which is not there because most of them died. And realizing, you know, what the context for the previous generation of queer people is. And obviously, because it's not something we learned about in schools, it just, and it was literally ignored by the government, has been bizarrely forgotten. There's this clip of Fran Lebowitz going around on Twitter that chilled me, honestly, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it, where she's talking about the audiences that were lost to AIDS. I think if you just Google Fran Lebowitz audience AIDS, you'll probably find it. It is, I don't know, it gives you a lot to think about. It floored me. And a way I've been putting it recently is that it's been haunting me a little bit. Because it's something, she's addressing something we just don't talk about, which has to do with the art that's been created in the last 20 to 30 years, and why. That's all I'll say. You can look it up. So that's Philadelphia from 1993, directed by Jonathan Demme. Oof, that felt like a lot of words to put into about the movie. That one is very fresh because I just watched it last week. So the sort of the thoughts and like enthusiasm to talk about it are very fresh. Next is The Lost Boys from 1987, directed by the Joel Schumacher. This movie I have been wanting to see since probably 2014. I feel like maybe when Taika Waititi said it was his favorite movie and was talking about how they referenced it in What We Do in the Shadows. The name sounded familiar to me, but I just bizarrely had never... I never, like, had it rented for me as a kid. Actually, I haven't really seen a lot of those sort of 80s movies. Like, The Goonies. The Goonies is on my list to watch because I haven't seen that one. But I love the Cyndi Lauper song from it, I have to say. Now, my interest to see this movie really peaked about a year and a half ago when Bat for Lashes came out with her latest album called The Lost Girls, which, as you can imagine, draws a huge amount of inspiration from this movie and that sort of Steven Spielberg adjacent 80s movie canon in general. So a lot of my impression about this movie and about like the tone and the mood of it came from that album and her aesthetics surrounding it. She says that the album sort of began as a screenplay she'd been writing, which involved like a girl gang of possible vampires who ride bikes in the LA desert and sort of terrorize a town. And then it turned into this album. And if you watch the video and listen to the song For Kids in the Dark, you can sort of see a little bit of that. Which when I first watched that video, because a lot of it is shot quite realistically, it feels almost documentary-like at times. And because I wasn't familiar with The Lost Boys, I was like, oh, okay. But then as the album sort of washed over me and again, now I watch it and I'm like, oh, just the feeling of that album, I think, really appropriately captures the feeling that this movie leaves you with. And I would even argue that I think Natasha Khan, who is Bat for Lashes, took all the best parts of The Lost Boys and infused them into that album and her own aesthetics. So when I finally watched this movie in October, I was sort of comparing it, holding it up next to this world that she had created that I felt so enthralled by, which was interesting. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, this is a movie about vampire punks who live near a seaside town that has a carnival. And lots of freaky people and new wave goths and punks hang out around this town. Now, I'd mostly only seen Joel Schumacher's Batman movies, which, on the record, I love. But it was really interesting to see this earlier movie and be like, oh, okay, yeah, like carnival, bright colored lights, like that is his thing. And like in the Batman's, it's sort of like polished a little bit more. But it was really interesting to get that sort of context for who he is as a director. This movie is all about the aesthetic to me. It's all about the feeling. It's all about the tone. And that's why I think Bat for Lash's use of it is so successful. There's two brothers, one's older, one younger, and they get mixed up with these vampires, and there's just some great looks. This movie gives you looks. In particular, one that has sort of taken over my being is Alex Winter in this movie as one of the vampires. He looks so beautiful. He has his blonde curly hair on top, but this flowing golden mullet going down his back behind. He wears this patchwork jacket, which is like Baroque and then 80s and pins and just sort of like super busy in a way that I find very satisfying. Oh my God, it's just such a look. I am so in love with how he looks in this movie. There's a shot of him sleeping upside down in the cave, and his hair is just falling straight down behind him in beautiful waves. I can't stop talking about it, but let's move on. The actual story of this movie, it's weird. It feels very uneven, but the parts that really stay with you are, yeah, the visuals and the music, particularly this theme song that sort of repeats throughout. It has these beautiful flying shots where you don't actually see the vampires fly till the end of the movie, which I think is very smart as an 80s movie way to not have to spend money on flying effects, but also create something that just feels really powerful. Yeah, I am very glad that I finally watched this movie and I have an even more full picture of this world that I can sort of get lost in. One thing that I should say is, like, one of the reasons I feel like Bat for Lashes took the best parts of it is it's a movie starring mostly boys from the 80s. It's misogynistic, it's sexist in a bunch of places. The second main female character in this movie doesn't really get a lot to do or a lot of agency, but Bat for Lashes takes it and makes a gang of girls. So yeah, I really appreciate that there's sort of this sort of refined version of this world that takes the good things and takes out the things I don't really like about it. I like to listen to this theme song a lot in the shower and just, like, feel very dramatic. I just love vampires. Next, Josie and the Pussycats from 2001, directed by Deborah Kaplan and Harry Elfont. Those legends. Another movie that it feels like I should have seen at some point, especially when I was a child, just loving those girl movies. There's certain movies that are iconic for the girls and the gays nowadays, and Josie and the Pussycats is one of them that I just never saw. I think when this movie came out, it got horrible reviews, which many people will say it's because they just didn't get it. And I mean, I have to agree, because I don't get how you can't love this movie. I think you have to hate fun. Of course, it's all about the Alan Cumming, as it always is for me. He's obviously very good, but also Parker Posey. I am so glad that I'm at a place in my life where I can fully appreciate Parker Posey. I love Parker Posey, and it's one of those things where as a child or a teenager, I did not have the cultural knowledge and sensibility to fully appreciate her. Oh, speaking of, if you haven't seen The Party Girl, it is a delight. Please watch that. Anyways, yes, Josie and the Pussycats. Just a movie full of, like, just hits you with little treats. There's a brief scene with Eugene Levy wearing a double denim outfit. One of the main things that I did not know about this movie, the plot sort of has to do with, like, commercialism and product placement. And so there's this intentional, really wild, completely, like, enveloping product placement throughout the movie where, like, there's a Target plane and they stay in a Revlon hotel room and everything is an advertisement for some corporation, which is obviously intentional and supposed to be satirical. One thing that I was thinking when I was watching it was, like, it's critiquing this, but also it seems like they made a lot of money for product placement. And I looked it up. I'm pretty sure they did not make any money from product placement, which I think is very nice to know. The way it's used in the sets in this movie is profoundly ugly. It's hard to look at. Like, there's a McDonald's shower. Just every room that they're in that has all this company branding. Like, I think it's successful, but it's almost like repulsive for the eyeball. Which is fascinating because I can't think of another movie that does that. It's like, it's balls to the walls. It's out there. The songs, there's like one song. No, okay, let's say two. There's two songs that really stick out to me and that I remember, but that's fine. It is what it is. Josie and Les Pussycats. Now, another underrated cozy 90s movie that I've been meaning to watch for a while is Only the Lonely from 1991, directed by Chris Columbus and starring the beloved John Candy. Now, this movie was on Netflix quite a few years ago, and I remember my mom being like, do you want to watch this? And it was one of those things where you see a movie on Netflix that you've never heard of, and you're like, but is it just going to be mediocre, and I started to feel weird watching it? And so I think I was like, nah, not today, but I do want to watch it, because I love John Candy so much. I don't think it's unique, but he makes me emotional and comforts me in a way I really treasure. And this is a honest-to-God romantic comedy starring John Candy, which is great. We all know a romantic comedy is one of my favorite things in this life. This movie is so sweet and nice, and it's funny, but also has a lot of very morbid humor, which I really appreciate. Now, the one thing with this movie is his character plays a Chicago cop, and there's sort of a running thing about it's good to be a cop because I get these perks or whatever. So if you can't stomach that, that's completely understandable, and maybe skip this one. Now, as I said at the top, enthusiasm comes in many forms. Sometimes it's not that I loved the bulk of a movie or everything it was doing, but it had a moment I cannot stop thinking about. Now, this year, I finally watched in full Something's Gotta Give with Diane Keaton and Jack Nicholson from 2003, directed by Nancy Meyers. There were other movies I could have talked about in this one's place, but I decided I absolutely need to talk about a moment in this movie that I am obsessed with. One, Diane Keaton is wearing a lot of turtlenecks and shades of vanilla. Her and Jack Nicholson are getting frisky. They're gonna have sex, but he can't get her out of her turtleneck. So Diane Keaton reaches on her bedside table, gets a gold pair of swan-shaped sewing scissors to give to him to cut her out of her turtleneck. There's a lot to say about this movie. Overall, it's a wild ride. Jack Nicholson's character is pretty repulsive. But is there another movie where Diane Keaton has somebody cut them out of her turtleneck with gold scissors in order to make love? No. Following quickly on the heels of this scene, you see them both in bed, post-coitally crying. Again, can you think of a movie where Diane Keaton and Jack Nicholson have sex and then both cry directly after? No. This movie's doing stuff. I don't know fully what it's doing, but I know it's doing stuff. And to cap off my list of movies I saw in 2020 that I feel enthusiastic about is another where one scene justified its presence on this list, and that is Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again! Now, if you've been on Twitter, I'm sure you've heard everything you possibly can about this movie. It's fun, it's bananas, Cher plays Meryl Streep's mom, even though she's 3 years older than her. That's all great. But the part of this movie I cannot stop returning to in my mind is the last scene where the whole cast, including different versions of characters, all gather to sing Super Trooper. It is so joyful. It is so colorful. It is so life-affirming. The end of this movie provided me with enough joy, possibly to last me for the rest of my life. I'm emotional even talking about it. It completely justifies the existence of the rest of the movie. It is everything. and going into this year, that's the energy that I want to carry with me. So if you're ABBA or Mamma Mia inclined, and you need a little pick-me-up during 2021, you can always watch the Super Trooper scene from Mamma Mia 2 and just have that in your back pocket, no matter what happens. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I've got a lot of great episodes coming up that I'm really excited to share with you. Those who've been listening so far, I appreciate you so, so much. I hope this holiday season was restful and restorative to you, and if it wasn't, I hope that you can take some time for some self-care and some nourishment for yourself, maybe possibly with one of these movies. Until next time, goodbye! Thank you, as always, to Sappho for providing the absolutely scintillating theme music you're hearing right now. You can listen to her album Time Machine on Spotify by searching Sappho Time Machine or clicking the link in the episode description.